Today, how much is too much? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today I'm joined for my normal Friday chat with journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
I'm hot. How are you doing?
About the same, mate. About the same.
Heat wave. Just to explain, heat wave has arrived for 3 days and everybody's wilting.
Yeah, something like that, mate. Well, you know, your subscriber numbers are looking pretty hot themselves. Congratulations on the 50,000.
Thank you. It's pretty surprising. I mean, I never dreamt years ago when I started, a couple of years ago. So I'm very grateful. And, next 50,000, I suppose, is now the target. So we know how much is too much there. What about stimulus, right? There was a really interesting chart that CBA put out, which you actually referenced, which just showed the quantum of stimulus is still massive.
It is. You just look at it compared with January last year, and it's still just completely, it's pretty similar really to sort of the April-May period in terms of the extra flows to households. And, considering the narrative of, the economy's fine, everything's fine, keep calm and carry on, it's not really, the two don't really line up.
No, and it's interesting because, of course, the latest provisional retail came out today, which showed a bit of a drop from November, but still, I think, 9.5% up from a year ago. So there's still money in the system, and we know that the savings ratio is still quite high, and we know that some people have actually got quite a lot of money to spend thanks to the government.
They do. And that's really, that's a point that people have been making, not only about Australia, but the world. And there was an article, I believe, from China Beige Book recently saying that in China, the recovery in spending is being driven by the wealthy. And that's something that we're seeing quite similarly. There was that article in The Australian a few days ago, which I referenced on Twitter, regarding the number of people going out and buying luxury goods, luxury cars, going on exorbitantly priced holidays, things that cost more for a fortnight than most of us earn in a year. So, there's that recovery of spending, but by the same token, if you're not someone who's been a recipient of additional stimulus payments or perhaps you're not someone who owns some of the assets that have been appreciating, you may be feeling a little bit cold as the reality of the economy begins to dawn in certain sectors.
Well, and of course, the unemployment data came out yesterday, and it was superficially okay insofar that the top line dropped a little, the participation went up. But the fact of the matter is, we've still got more people unemployed than a year ago. And once again, I think, as we've touched on previously, this is bifurcation, right? If you're in the right camp and you're employed and you're receiving all the support, then everything's fine. But if you're in the other camp, it's a totally different story. And all of the focus is at the moment on the upside rather than the downside.
It is. And I think it's also just important to keep in mind just how enormous the amount of stimulus flowing through the economy is. In the last 10 months now, we're looking at about $300 billion flowing into the economy. Now, that's an enormous sum of money. It's huge. I mean, I think that in some ways the scale of the stimulus is somewhat lost, because you just go, oh, well, it's $300 billion and it's such an abstract figure that most people, myself included, just go, well, how much is that? What could we buy with $300 billion? But to put that into perspective, it's over 60% of the last year before the pandemic impacted the budget, of the entire federal budget flowing into the economy over 10 months. And that's just, it's huge. And I think that, I read all these economists saying, oh, look at this chart. It looks wonderful. Let's extrapolate that off into the future. And I just go, $300 billion is shed loads of money. We should be very cautious extrapolating trends. And more than that, our economy, relatively speaking, I know this is going to annoy some people, but here we go. Relatively speaking, has been not very impacted by the virus if you're comparing us with the US or Europe, who have been hit by an absolute freight train relative to Australia. And yet our stimulus package is 86% bigger than Britain's.
Yep.
That's insane. I just feel like saying to people, oh, but the labor market's booming, retail sales are booming. Well, of course it's booming. You threw $300 billion at it.
Yeah. So basically what's happening is that money that has been created out of, you wonder where it's been created from in terms of the quantitative easing and everything else and all the borrowing is flowing back into the economy. And so that's sort of turning the treadmill around. but it's not necessarily creating good sustainable momentum into the future. It's very much a life support type mode. And, you know, there are still businesses struggling. And of course, now I think the Prime Minister has come out and said, well, we're not going to provide any extra support for the tourist sector ahead. So we know that they're going to continue to struggle. So you've got to ask yourself the question, how much more stimulus will be poured in? How much longer will this jig continue? And when ultimately are we going to account for it?
I think it's really going to depend on a sector by sector basis. I mean, you know, you're seeing this enormous push at the moment, you know, in with the construction sector, you know, with home builder, with all these people rushing in to try and get it before the end of the year. And now again, we're going to see the same thing again, because it's going to be tapered. It's been tapered, and now it's going to conclude at the end of March, like pretty much every other means of support. But I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we see that extended again, because, you know, it's the government's favorite engine of growth. But by the same token, in terms of things that actually drive the rest of the real economy, the rest of the real productive economy, I don't really see a whole lot out there, to be honest. And that's just really the ideological, what would you call it, agenda of the way this government functions. Like I've been, you know, doing a little bit of research for some articles I'm working on at the moment about the planned response of the coalition back in 2008. And this is pretty much what we're doing exactly now. In 2008, Malcolm Turnbull suggested tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, you know, basically this, you know, enormous supply side response, which is exactly what we're getting now 12 years later.
Yeah, it is the same old playbook. I have to say the last one didn't do us too well. If you look at what happened post it, it took a long time for it to come through. And a lot of it was to do with the cut in interest rates that flowed afterwards, right? Well, we've already cut interest rates to as low as they can go, pretty much, so that plan is pretty much out of it. So you've got to ask the question, how are we going to wean ourselves off? And, you know, it's interesting. Everything is now tapering down to the end of March. So at the end of March, you know, on the current timeline, we lose all of the final loan support from those people who've got interest and principal repayment holidays on their mortgages. JobKeeper and JobSeeker will stop. A number of the other things, like, as you say, HomeBuilder will stop. It's going to be a bit crickets after that, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think the thing is, like, we've got another, technically speaking, we've got another $250 billion coming from the federal government. But a lot of that is infrastructure spending, which is up to 10 years away. So that's a little bit, you know, including that is a little bit, you know, sort of misleading in terms of how much is actually going to be flowing through in the shorter term. So it's going to be really interesting how the economy is going to cope with, you know, the lesser spending, because, I mean, I think the thing is that it's all and good for people to say, oh, but the economy is going to recover. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. But in a lot of ways, I feel like there's a lot of parallels here with World War II once again, because it's at the end of World War II, you had an economy switch from a heavy, heavy reliance on the production of goods to try and flip to then go back to a services-based economy. Well, not a services, but a more services-focused economy. And that's exactly what we're going to have. That's the challenge that we're going to have to see, you know, again. Except this time, you know, we're not going to have, you know, the Chifley government pouring money into building enormous amounts of social housing, for example. It's, you know, let's give businesses up to $5 billion in turnover tax cuts instead.
Yeah, and as that we said before, that's fine if they're actually wanting to invest and can invest. Interestingly, the last Roy Morgan business survey that came out was actually remarkably positive.
We're seeing a certain degree of positivity, but I think the thing that's interesting is that we haven't seen a recovery in business credit to a significant degree. It's still declining, and you're also seeing it being paid down fairly significantly in the RBA aggregate credit data as well.
Yep.
But it's also the fact that businesses are reticent to employ full-time employees, and until that changes, the recovery is going to be, well, shall we say, incomplete.
That's right. And of course, the other factor to bear in mind in all of these numbers, particularly the more recent ones, is Victoria came back on stream. So you would have expected to see a considerable boost in the numbers because Victoria opened up. It'll be interesting to see whether that momentum really does continue, or whether in fact that was a one-off and then we get back to a different trajectory ahead. Talking about trajectories ahead, of course, the other question is home prices. And now lot of the analysts are saying, oh, home prices will be up 10 or 15%. You know, UBS has come out, Westpac's come out, various other people too. So everyone's now predicting home price rises. And referencing, of course, that piece of work that was done by Peter Tulip when he was at the Reserve Bank on the fact that if you cut 100 basis points off the rate and leave it there, then you see a 30% rise in home prices.
I think that that's all well and good in a vacuum. You know, if everything, you know, if all else remains equal and all that sort of thing and everything remains the same, then sure. You know, you cut 100 basis points and everything's hunky-dory, then people are going to go out there, they're going to spend big on property. You know, you're probably going to see a firing of the investor sector, etc. But, and this is a pretty big but, we don't know what lays ahead for the economy, for confidence, for all these different things. Because I think the thing is that Australians have experienced an absolutely unprecedented amount of support from the government. Over the last 10 months, it's been off the charts. It makes Rudd's, you know, I mean, literally Rudd's stimulus here, total government committed support here. I'll send Martin a graph. It's literally completely off the chart in terms of the size and scope of both stimuluses. And not only that, but Rudd's was done over 4 years. This has been done in 10 months. So it's, once again, you know, sort of this enormous, you know, enormous block of cheese versus a tiny piece of chalk. But it's interesting that, you know, we make these calls based on, you know, the way things are. But I think it's really interesting because Australians have become much, much more confident about things, perhaps even more confident than they were before under some measures, like according to Westpac's index anyway. I mean, they're, you know, decade high levels of confidence. Mm. But is that confidence still going to be there when they take away the cookie jar?
Well, I think that's a good question. And then the other question you've got to ask yourself is, will the rollout of the vaccine be effective? And will it really get the virus under control? And will the international borders really be able to open in a few months' time, given what's happening globally? I mean, there are still some downside risks, it seems to me, specifically relating to the pandemic, which are not really being factored in.
No, and there is, you know, growing concern amongst, you know, epidemiologists and virologists about whether or not the vaccine will be effective against some of these other strains like the South African strain or the Brazilian strain, you know, and others are emerging, you know, with each passing day, you know. But it's, I mean, that's something that's frankly beyond my pay grade and, you know, beyond my sort of ability to commentate on meaningfully. But it is something that is a rather serious risk going forward. And I just think it's interesting because you've got all these sort of people like Jeremy Grantham and people like that, you know, seasoned investors who've seen bubbles come and go, who are all saying that this is all going to end in tears in the not too distant future, you know, like sometime later this year. And it's frankly hard to disagree with them because I remember people said to me back in like July last year, everything's going to be fine. You know, you're going to see, you know, look at the warmer weather in Europe and the US, the virus is going to be taken care of, blah, 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 blah. And I said to them, no, we're going to see more lockdowns in Europe. And people said, no, you're wrong, you're dumb. And here we are. And I think we just need to acknowledge those further downsides in the real economy that are possible. I mean, like the Japanese have basically said they're going to cancel the next Olympics, not cancel it, postpone it. But, you know, you're seeing lockdowns being extended in Europe. And I just don't think that there's this political will to keep the money tap flowing full pelt forever and ever.
Well, it's an interesting question. How much is too much, isn't it? And of course, it's worth reflecting on the fact that there is now a bigger lockdown in China than previously, you know, in and around some of their major centres. They've got issues there. And we also know, of course, that the projections are for more deaths both in Europe and the UK and in the US before it gets better. And of course, the sheer logistics of rolling out these vaccines on a huge scale, both globally and you know, within countries, is remarkably big challenge. And of course, the World Health Organization did call out the fact that it was rich countries nabbing all the vaccines.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that we're going to see, you know, become a significant issue as time goes by, especially, you know, like some people are saying that this could be something that we have to be vaccinated against every 6 or 9 months. You know, if we see these new strains coming through, reducing the effectiveness to 40, 50, 60%, and they need to, you know, go in, you know, rejig the vaccine and then do it again and again and again. I mean, you know, you whether or not that's going to be the case or not is just obviously speculation. But we're in the West, okay, maybe we can sort of manage that if we really get our act together. But if you're talking about a place like China or a place like India, with the sheer number of people and the sheer scope of that sort of vaccination program, I don't know how they're going to do it. Mm. I mean, I assume they could with this sort of like wartime-esque effort and, you know, organization, but, you know, that sort of thing takes time.
Yeah, and we don't know the full effects of rolling it out, of course. And, you know, I've got a theory, because there's a bit of a significant spike in terms of auctions listed for the next two or three weeks. In fact, Lou Christopher published some information. It's in the Financial Review today. And he's highlighting the fact that compared with last year, it's just a very significant rise. It's reflecting the same data I saw in my surveys, that intention to sell was very strong. And when I looked at the data closely, people are actually wanting to get in before the end of March and before the impact of the virus or the vaccine comes through. So there is this sort of window of opportunity that they see to actually hit the market. So it'll be very interesting to see how that impacts things locally.
Well, that's going to be something that's very interesting, because we've seen listings, at least according to the CoreLogic numbers, come down significantly. You know, we're talking about the data only goes back about 10 years that I've seen, but we're well below the lows of anywhere in the last decade.
Yep.
SQM tells a bit of a different story, but, you know, that's differences in methodology. Mm. But that is going to be something interesting, because if we do see this big explosion in the number of listings, you know, this big rise, you know, over a relatively short period of time, that could create some very interesting pressures within the property market. You know, like potentially downward pressures. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on what could potentially happen if we do see a big uptick in listings?
Well, it all comes down to how many of those people in my surveys who said we are likely to list actually go ahead and list. If they all did, then there would be a significant oversupply of property, particularly in the major centres, relative to demand. So you would expect to see prices continue to slide in some of those major urban areas, particularly units. Units is where a lot of the pain is, but houses too. However, in regional areas, it's a very different story. There is a much lower intention to list, and yet there's also stronger demand. So people are actually looking to move out of our major centres into regional areas. So I think there's going to be some differential movement. I also think that we're going to see some quite interesting dynamics over in the West, because prices in Perth are just up a little at the moment. There are quite a few people over there saying, oh, now is the time to get out, because I've ridden this for 5 to 8 years. Prices have come down a long way. A little bit out of an uptick is actually worth capitalizing on. So I think we're going to see quite an interesting supply there. And I think there'll be lower listings in Adelaide and in Tasmania, because then the dynamic's not quite the same. So I think it's a patchy regional story. But overall, I think that that might put a little bit of a slide on many prices.
It's going to be interesting to watch. I'm actually very curious to see what the impact of the vaccine is going to be on the market, on how, if we're going to see a shift back towards the city. Because I was reading an article in Wolf Street, that blog, and by a DC, Washington DC real estate agent and property commentator, and she was saying that there are people out there who now both heads of the household have had the vaccine, and they've turned around and they've gone, I'm not really sure if I want to live out here.
Yes.
You know, I'm not sure if I want to live in a regional area or then out a suburban area. You know, well, what if I have to go back into the office? What if I've got to go in there 3 or 4 days a week, and working from home is going to be the minority rather than the majority of my time? So that could be something that could really sort of flip the market on its head quite quickly, especially for these regional areas that have seen prices bid up very, very, very quickly. Because, you know, you've got, generally in regional areas, you know, the supply is very, very limited. You know, some postcodes, you know, you maybe only see a couple hundred listings a year. But if you all of a sudden, you know, and you've got thousands of people all wanting to come in, but if that flips, all of a sudden you've got all these people in regional areas expecting telephone numbers that aren't going to get them.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, years ago when I was in the UK, I commuted an hour and a half morning and evening to get from house to the office in London, right? And that was pretty much standard for a lot of the people in the area. Now, when you don't have to do that, it actually changes the complete perspective in terms of, you know, centers of gravity and things. But if you then have to start doing it again, those long commutes get really, really wearing week in, week out, you know, day in, day out, especially if the the trains don't run on time, as they quite often didn't in the UK. It was always a bit of a hassle. So I wonder whether we will see a swing back, and whether, in fact, the regional spike that we have currently got is just temporary.
Yeah, well, I tend to have the reputation for being the bearish one in terms of, you know, the return to normality. But I think that there's sort of a certain inertia, some, you know, of the status quo. And, you know, humans have always gravitated back to this, back to city living sooner or later. I mean, you know, we've had plagues, you know, we've had wars, we've had cities being burned to the ground, but we always return to the city nonetheless. And I'm just wondering if that's going to happen again this time, because, I mean, as you say, you know, it's all well and good now. You're out, you've bought your place out in the Blue Mountains, or, you know, up on the north coast, south coast of Sydney. You know, you maybe come in once or twice a month and you go, oh, the commute's a bit long, but I've only got to deal with it a couple of times a month and I can live with that. But if all of a sudden it becomes once or twice a week and you just think, oh, well, I'm not really sure I want to do that, like, as you say, and it's just, it's something that, you know, people just tend to just gravitate back to what they know. You know, they gravitate back to the, and I think not only that, but I think a lot of people are very much missing the social interaction and the interpersonal sort of, you know, element of work, because, you know, that's just the kind of person they are. Some people can work from home, some people can't.
Well, I guess that is true. But I think the other issue is the commercial end of it. So I was listening to somebody talking about Canary Wharf in the UK again. You know, that's a very highly developed area, which is close into the centre of London, but a little bit remote. And they had 12% occupancy relative to normal in all the major offices in and around Canary Wharf, 12%, right? And there was a big debate going on between the two people I was listening to as to whether that was a permanent change or a temporary change. And you could hear the people who own the towers basically pleading for people to come back, because they knew that the commercial structure that they've got and the rental streams are likely to get blown up unless they can get that occupancy rate back up again. Plus, of course, all the local businesses are also feeling it too. So there's a real interesting commercial contention, firstly. Secondly, if you talk to business leaders, they're sort of a little more comfortable with using remote tools and what have you, but they still want to keep an eye on their workers, and they still think there's an important teaming process that needs to be there. So there's always going to be a swing back that way. And then the third point, I think, is right as well, which is, well, what is the normal, you know, normal mode of operation? It has tended to be in and around offices, teams working together, and I suspect over time that probably is a drift back too. So I'll be interesting to see whether the digital revolution really has fundamentally changed the game and blown up commercial property, or whether it actually swings back and commercial properties survive. Otherwise, there'll be a lot of conversion of offices into more apartments.
Yeah, well, that's just what we need more of. No, it's interesting, because the thing with commercial real estate is that, unlike, you know, residential real estate, it's a lot more sensitive to vacancies.
Yep.
You know, if you start to see significant vacancies in a commercial real estate sense, both in offices or retail, it impacts the rents far, far more significantly than it does in the residential sphere. So that's something that I think is really interesting, because they're still building offices like mad. That hasn't stopped. You know, there's still, I mean, you still read the AFR and it's like, oh, you know, this office is going up, this company or this property trust is investing in more and more office space, and that's not slowing down. And I just think that even if you get down to, say, sort of the low 90s occupancy rates over a sustained period, that is going to create severe downward pressure on commercial real estate prices. We don't need to see a full-on sort of shift to online work for commercial real estate to be completely crushed in terms of prices. And we've seen that happen before, even in the US.
Well, that's right. I mean, even if you have a 10% reduction in your demand for space, right? So, you know, just less people coming in and perhaps more hot desking, that could spill over quite significantly, and as you say, create a lot of potential spare stuff. And the other point, of course, is that people tend to want to gravitate to the really new modern stuff and, you know, move from the older stuff. So you end up with more sort of ghetto areas, which is perhaps older and more developed, and then the new stuff, which is perhaps where people concentrate, that isn't necessarily healthy either way, by the way, as well. So I think there's a lot of questions. And the other interesting thing, I mean, I used to work at King's Cross in the UK, which was an older area, has a pretty bad reputation, but a lot of the office premises there were actually quite old. And over a period of about 2 or 3 years, a lot of people moved out of that area into more modern buildings down at Canary Wharf or over in the city. And that whole area went downhill. It became unsafe to walk around in the evening. And so there was a sort of a decaying spiral down created by the lack of occupancy.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, that's something that we haven't really experienced that much in Australia in recent decades. And I think, I suppose, you could attribute part of that to just the consistent growth in population. You know, people need somewhere to live. But now with zero immigration and the fact that they're just building stuff like mad, I mean, you know, I think we've got like record numbers of homes being built once all of these, you know, various contracts are started. I mean, it could get quite interesting. And I'm actually quite curious, like, given that the banks do have quite a lot of exposure to commercial real estate, do you think that could be something that could create a potential sort of tightening of credit scenario if we did see sort of large drops in the value of commercial real estate?
Well, I think it's a great question. And the banks have actually been dialing back their exposure to commercial real estate for about 2.5 to 3 years. So they've actually got less today than they have previously. And it's quite interesting if you talk to some of the commercial construction entities, they're finding it very difficult to get funding from the banks here. A lot of the new builds were actually being funded by Chinese money, although that's now been tapered back. So my own view is that we will see less forward investment in the sector, which then leads the question to what happens to the older buildings, the ones that have already been there, the ones that are owned by pension funds or other investors at the moment. And if you have a lower level of occupancy, or indeed if rents continue to fall as they are in many places. I was talking to somebody the other day who's in the sector, and they basically got a 30% cut on their commercial rent because they're happy to take anything. So, I mean, the economics, the whole economics question is really interesting. And of course, then if the economics don't work, what does that do for the investors? There's a lot of superannuation money in property and real estate trusts, and they haven't performed very well.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking as you were talking about it. You know, a 30% drop in rents is, you know, a 30% plus drop in the value of the property. Because, you know, unlike residential where you can just negatively gear it and just throw it all in never never, you know, it actually, there's actually a strong correlation and relationship between rents and values. So that's something that I just think this is going to be really, really interesting going forward, because a lot of these losses haven't been realized by these super funds and everything. And I think that's something that the viewers should potentially watch out for and potentially look into themselves. Because if you're in a fund that invests heavily in commercial real estate, that's perhaps something that you should look at and examine, probably with someone who is, you know, more qualified to commentate on your individual circumstances than we are.
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, you've got the listed real estate trusts which have a portfolio, but there's a lot of private investments in real estate, particularly commercial real estate, right, which is not really publicly valued or publicly listed. So you wonder what valuations are held within those super entities and what assumptions are being made about future revenue flows from that particular sector. I think we're going to see some more bad news there down the track, personally.
Well, that's something that I agree, and that's something that they've been talking about even in Europe. Like there was an article in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal yesterday, talking about how the fact that there's all these various real estate trusts and real estate companies who develop all these sites, who own all this property, and the fact that these risks to the values of their portfolios are not being priced into their bonds. Yep. You're seeing, you know, like these companies borrowing at, you know, 1.6%, despite the fact that some of these properties might be worth 30, 40, 50% less than their book value.
Yep. This reminds me of 2008 and the question of what the value of those mortgages were, right, relative to the value of the property.
Exactly. And I think that's yet another sort of potential contagion for the system. You know, there's the commercial real estate thing, there's the junk bond side of things as well, which is, and then there's the junk bonds which are linked to the commercial real estate. So that's sort of, you know, you know, a debt disaster squared potentially.
Well, indeed. And it's interesting, you know, whether you saw Yellen's comments, she's obviously putting some stuff out there in terms of being approved by the, you know, the new Senate and what have you. But it's interesting that she was making some comments about the future trajectory of the economy in the US and what needs to be done. And there was definitely some indications of more spending coming.
There is. And I think that, to be honest, I think that the market is sort of pricing things a little bit wrong on that, because I think that it's all well and good for Yellen to get up there and say, oh, we want to do this, we want to do that. But, you know, Yellen isn't really the one who ultimately holds the purse strings. It's Congress who holds those. And I think that there's going to be sort of significant problems for the future passage of, like, don't get me wrong, they'll probably get through these $2,000 stimulus checks and or $1,400 depending on who you ask, you know. It's all about definition, but, you know, something to that effect probably in the not too distant future. It'll take time because they're you know, the whole impeachment situation with Trump and everything else. But beyond that, I think that there's going to be a real issues. And I think it's all good for the market to go, oh, but little grandma Yellen is gonna you know, fire up the money printing machine to a million. But in reality, I think she's going to be hamstrung by, you know, a fairly powerful Republican, you know, minority, or basically that they have the same number of seats and Kamala Harris has the deciding vote. So I think that there's going to be a lot more political gridlock than people expect. And I think that that's going to weigh not only on the US but on the global economy more broadly.
Well, I think that's right. And she did say that some of those earlier programs which have tapered away won't be brought back. So, you know, she's recognizing, I think, some limitations there. But more broadly on the US, I mean, we've seen the transition of power. We obviously saw those horrendous scenes a couple of weeks ago, and you know, Biden's come, I guess, out with a, you know, call to union, a call to, you know, pull together. What's your sense? Is that realistic, or are the fractures that live in the US psyche too deep?
I hope it's realistic. My heart hopes it's realistic. My brain says, nah. Right. Nah, sorry, mate. I wish it was realistic, but we're already seeing divisions develop, you know, both between the left and the right and within the left itself. Because, you know, you're going to... The left is in a position of power for the first time they hold a majority in all three. They've got the White House, they've got the Senate, they've got Congress, at least on paper. So there's going to be that pressure from the left, you know, from the very, very vocal social media element of the Democratic Party to press for all these various different changes while they have the power. Because, you know, usually these super majorities don't last for very long. They usually last for 2 years, maybe 4 years at the most.
Yep.
So that's something that is really going to create a lot of division in the Democratic Party. I mean, we already saw that to a degree before the election when they were trying to force a vote to get Medicare for All through Congress and, you know, put it to the Senate. And I think that that's just going to be emblematic of what we're going to see going forward. And, you know, all these Trump voters are not just going to go away. You know, and not only that, but now that Trump is gone, you know, I mean, he's out of the White House, but he's never going to be gone entirely until he's really gone, so to speak. But these people, the Republican Party now needs to win these people's votes back somehow. They've got 2 years until the midterms, and they need to completely reinvent their party without Trump. So they're going to return in all likelihood to fiscal conservatism, to hammering away about every dollar that's being spent, to, you know, more make America great again, more, you know, more military spending, you know, more, you know, more sort of the US asserting itself globally, that sort of thing. And I don't think that's really going to play well with what the Democrats want, because they want this domestically focused agenda, big, big spending, while on the other hand, Republicans are going to want something entirely different. And something for the viewers who are perhaps not familiar with US politics to keep in mind is, unlike Australia, where politicians generally vote with their party, in America, they're much, much more likely to vote against their party in order to get something that they want for their state or for their constituents in their congressional district. So, I mean, we've already seen multiple Democrat senators break away to say, oh, well, I want this or I want that in this stimulus bill. And that's going to be something that's going to hold things up, because a lot of people are just thinking, oh, but the Democrats control everything. If this was like Australia, they just pass everything through. They'd have universal healthcare and all this other sort of stuff overnight. But no, that's not the way it works. Not in America anyway.
No, actually. Well, there are some things, of course, that he can do basically just on a signature, and that's already happening, right? Some things around the virus, for example, and changes to the borders and stopping the building of the wall. Right? So those things are easy. But the stuff you're talking about is the hard yards. And my perspective is somewhat similar to yours, insofar that the fault lines that run through the US are still there. And it's not like you've got a clean, polarization and effectively a big pool of middle ground that people can occupy. It's much more fractured than that. And therefore, I think it's going to be quite complex and difficult. And I don't think they've necessarily got consensus in terms of what they want to be when they grow up.
No, they don't. That's very true. And I think the thing is that it's all well and good to sort of, you know, people look back on various presidents who've, you know, sort of united America behind them, people like Roosevelt, or even, you know, in a more modern era, someone like Reagan. But the problem is we don't live in 1988 or 1944 anymore. We've got, there's not four channels on the TV, you know, all of which switch off after a certain period, a certain time at night. You know, we've got social media. We've got, you know, news networks coming up the wazoo. You've got journalists who love nothing more than to throw, you know, petrol, you know, loaded petrol tankers worth of fuel on this fire. And that's the problem. You know, it's all well and good to call for unity, and I think that's important. And Biden is doing the right thing on that, and I'm behind him on that absolutely in principle. But when you look at things from a more realistic perspective, from a broader overview, rather than just what's Biden doing and saying, when you look at what the media is doing and saying, and the people on social media who are the sort of drivers of, you know, the public opinion within their own individual spheres on each side of politics, that's very, very different. They're still at each other's throats. They still, you know, they still basically want to kill each other. And that isn't going to change. Frankly, I don't know what will change that. You know, I mean, that's probably something beyond my pay grade. You know, that's something for, you know, these sort of people who did, you know, psyops back in the Cold War and that sort of thing to all sit around a table and work out.
Well, you're right on the various cross currents on social media and all of the different opinions. And I think it's more polarized rather than less polarized now that the election result is through and Biden's in place. And what I'm fascinated personally is to see the very entrenched positions that people are taking on both sides of the aisle, as it were. I don't see that going away anytime soon. And that means that there's always going to be the noise. And then, whether Trump creates a new party called, was it the Patriot Party or something, or whether he creates a new social media channel for his own use, I don't know. But, there's a whole lot of complexity ahead, it seems to me. And whilst the call to unity I absolutely support, I have a feeling that the hard yards are definitely still in front of them.
No, I agree. There's this great scene from 2008, I believe it was, when McCain lost the election to Obama, and he's up there about to give his concession speech, and it gets announced that Obama is going to be the president and et cetera, and everyone starts booing, and everyone's booing and they're all rowdy and they're all angry, and McCain gets up there and, you know, he tries to sort of calm the situation and say, no, this man is our president and we are going to support him and support our country, because that's the sort of person that McCain was. Mm. But you don't have McCain anymore. You have Trump, and you're going to have Trump's replacement. And the thing that people don't realize about politics is that these people go and have dinner with each other after. You know, they may throw all sorts of crap at each other. They may hate each other publicly, but when you look at them afterwards, they're all buddy buddy. They're all sit down. They'll have a bottle of wine together at a restaurant in D.C. Or that, you know, say for example, you saw the other day, you saw Bush and the Obamas together. They're the best of friends. You know, the divide between, you know, you'd think, you know, judging by the ideology of the people on social media, that you'd have to have the Secret Service pulling them apart so they don't kick the crap out of each other. But that's not the way it works, and that's not the way it works in overall. But But social media and the media have amplified these divisions. And as you say, I don't know how you fix that, to be completely frank with you.
No, well, I mean, it is theatre. It is absolutely theatre. And it's theatre in an amplification system that can become deafening very, very quickly. Mind you, of course, in Australia, if Google go through with their threat to withdraw Google in Australia, then we won't hear much about it, will we?
I'm not so sure if they're going to do that. I mean, I suppose in a way, losing 25 million customers in a developed nation is a small price to pay to send a message that, you know, we have a monopoly and we want to keep it. But it's going to be interesting to see just exactly how social media is going to cope with all this stuff, because, you know, it's all well and good for the, you know, for everyone to go, oh, it was all Parler, it was all this right-wing fringe thing that was used to organize it. But, you know, there's fairly sort of significant evidence that suggests that, you know, it's Twitter and Facebook and every other, you know, social media platform was used as well.
Absolutely. And of course, a lot of them are worried that if, in fact, the Australian government is successful in basically finding a way to charge them for content from the local creators, as it were, that could be a model that's then replicated in other countries. So they're going to do their damnedest to try and stop it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be something that we're going to increasingly see across the board with government challenging tech. Because, you know, Twitter were unimaginably stupid for banning Trump. Not because I support Trump's agenda and stuff like that, but in terms of how that's going to impact their business. Because now politicians from both sides of the aisle in countries around the world are all coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, if you're censoring that, you need to censor this, 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 and this. And that's increasingly going to be the pressure that they've created and now placed upon themselves. So I think that was pretty dumb in hindsight, just purely from a business perspective.
Well, it does come back to whether they're publishers or whether they're just a platform, right? And I think they've proved that they're publishers.
Yeah, that's exactly. You're either a curator of content or you're not. And once you start doing that, you become the, you know, you've become the arbiter, then you've opened yourself up to potentially being regulated and other people deciding what's appropriate content and what isn't.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I remember years ago I was reading a book about, in fact, it was about the BBC, and there was a chapter in there about news and how news is actually put together. And it suddenly dawned on me, because I hadn't really thought of it before, that in fact somebody is making a decision, a proactive decision about the relative priority of what comes first, what comes second, what comes third, and what is not reported, right? So behind every news story and every news outlet, there is an ideology and there's a set of processes in train.
Yeah, there is. Absolutely. And not only that, but part of the problem as well now is, like, say, for example, like people talk about the various news sources in the US, right? And one of the reasons why some of them are so successful is because they pander to the very type of ideology of the people that read, of their readers. So you start a right-wing news website, right? You find that hard right news stories end up getting more viewers. And then you go, okay, well, we're going to publish more of that. That's going to be 1, 2, and 3. And then all of a sudden, over time, you just go more, a little bit further to the right, a little bit further to the right, a little bit further to the right, until all of a sudden, your right-wing news site has become a hard-right news site that's very, very successful. And just before anyone says that I'm being unfair against the right, the exact same thing happens on the other end of the ideological spectrum too.
Absolutely. And, of course, the algorithms that underpin it and propagate it will propagate news that actually is popular to those who actually want that type of news. So there's a self-reinforcing process, which means that effectively you're going to get more of the stuff that you're interested in and less of the stuff you're not interested in.
Exactly. And it's really an extension of the classic, you know, social media bubble that people talk about. Yep. You know, you through the algorithms and through everything and through the curation of your own content and the things that you choose to like, you've created a bubble, you know. Unless you explicitly get set out to follow and to include things that challenge you and challenge your views. And so you create, so just hypothetically, this hypothetical person has created this bubble, and then they've gone on the internet and they've gone on some, you know, hard left news website, and then all of a sudden their viewing of the content has extended that bubble, and that bubble now encompasses that news website. And so you've just seen these growing bubbles. And the problem with these bubbles, and because they've become so large, is that they're far more reinforcing of people's beliefs, because it's like, look at all the people that agree with me. Hmm. There's all these tens of millions, 100 million people who agree with me. How could we be wrong?
Hmm. Yep. Well, it's an echo chamber, and it's a self-confirming echo chamber, and it's a self-confirming echo chamber that will reinforce the frame of reference that you work within and assume is correct.
Yeah. Exactly, because it's like, well, you know, I believe in all this, you know, whatever's woke this week, you know, that I believe in that. And it's like, well, okay, that's cool, but you don't need to force your beliefs on everybody else. It's like, no, this is what my bubble says is moral and righteous. Hmm. And if you don't share my belief, it's not moral and righteous. Or if you don't agree that the election was stolen, you're not moral and righteous. So there's just this thing going on the two fringes, and there's everyone in the middle just going, what the hell's going on?
Well, you're highlighting for me the most critical thing, which is it becomes a religion, right?
Yeah.
It actually doesn't matter what the facts are, right?
No.
It becomes a set of beliefs. It becomes an ideology. It becomes a fact that you cannot even argue against.
Honestly, I find it I find it quite scary in a lot of ways, because it's that sort of religious belief, that dogmatic belief, that's how you get Hitlers, that's how you get Mussolinis, that's how you get people. I mean, I'm not saying that's what's happening now, but that's how that's the type of thing ends.
Yep.
And honestly, like, I just, this is going to piss everyone off, so here we go. People know I'm not a huge fan of Scott Morrison. People know that. Hmm. Right? But then by the same token, sometimes I'll go out there and I'll say, look, This is pandering to Scott Morrison's base, and this is benefiting him. And people will just go ballistic at me, and I'll cop all sorts of crap for it. You know, my DMs filled up with, you know, oh, you're a right wing nut job, blah 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 blah. I get the same, I get the same thing from some other people if I go after the left sometimes, and it's ridiculous. You know, like they say this Australia Day stuff with Cricket Australia. Oh my God, that is such an own goal for the left in this country. You know, I can just imagine all of the swing voters that I know in these sort of, you know, classic, you know, middle class, you know, what do they call them, aspirational areas, who are going to be looking at this and they're going to go, this is bullshit. ScoMo's right, and it's just. Giving him just the biggest free kick. But for some people, you can't say that because ScoMo is evil, and therefore you must not ever say anything positive about him. And I've written quite a lot of positive stuff about ScoMo when he does it. But, you know, I mean, that's balanced news. If you don't want balanced news, you know, go on Facebook and rant with a bunch of people who agree with you.
Yeah, but the point is that balanced news and religion are two completely different things. I'm using religion with a little r rather than the big r, right? But, you know, religion is an ideology. It's a particular perspective that is all-encompassing, explains everything. You don't need to step beyond it, right? That's the definition of religion, and that's what you end up with. So you end up people within their little bubbles, their particular ideological bubbles, and anything beyond that is just beyond the pale.
Yeah. It's so ridiculously self-enforcing. Like I look at some of these Twitter accounts sometimes on both sides of politics, and I'll see them, and they'll be spouting some hard right or hard left thing, you know, that's completely lacking in nuance, and you know, it's not only that, but it's literally all they do. You know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong, I spew plenty of crap on Twitter like everybody else, but by the same token, you get me criticizing everyone. And you watch how these accounts grow and grow and grow from nothing into people who have 15, 20, 100,000, you know, 100,000 followers, you know, over the period of a relatively short period of time. And it's just so stunning how self-reinforcing these things are. And I just can't help but think, you know, it just puts us on the same path as America. You know, if we can't say that Daniel Andrews screwed up horribly and his government made a lot of mistakes, but at the same time also say that ScoMo screwed up horribly and he made a lot of mistakes, well, where are we? We need to be able to look at things objectively and say that when and hold our politicians accountable.
Well, I agree with that absolutely. But, you know, my observation is that people live in their little frame of reference and don't realize it. And therefore, they never look over the fence, as it were. And therefore, they tend to chime in to a particular angle of attack, a particular way of thinking, and anything beyond it is beyond the pale. That is the way of disaster and, frankly, anarchy, in my view. But that is often the way that we seem to be heading.
It's kind of disturbing because I think about the way things were even just before civil wars. Mm. You know, I'm not saying that that's going to happen now or it's going to happen soon or anything like that, but just purely from a broader overall, you know, psychological perspective. Mm. You know, when people, even in civil wars, went to war over the leadership or government or ideology of their country, a lot of them didn't do it with hatred in their hearts. They did it because solely that was what they believed. They didn't hate people who disagreed with them. They disagreed with them enough to go and fight, but they didn't hate them in the way that people hate, in the way that some people hate each other today. Hmm. And I think that is probably the most scary thing of all. You know, I mean, like I remember like watching these documentaries, you know, about propaganda, about how the enemies were dehumanized during wars. And rather than this being this sort of big psyop effort by a government, we're dehumanizing people who disagree with us. You know, I speak as, you know, very, very broadly as, you know, people, as in people in society.
Yep.
Dehumanizing their ideological enemies, because no one can believe that and still be a good person. And that's just, it's just so wrong. You know, like there are people who have beliefs and opinions that I don't like, that I find, that in some cases I find morally reprehensible, but that doesn't mean that belief isn't valid and that they have the right to it, as much as I may disagree with them.
Yeah, and that of course is the point, right? Because you know, there's the old adage about you defend anybody's right to express an alternative opinion, but it has to be done, I think, in a rather civilized and civil manner, rather than just the sort of polarization that we get. And, you know, maybe DFA has a little bit of a role to play here in terms of just not painting ourselves into a particular corner, but actually trying to paint a slightly broader perspective. And I do on the channel try and get people with slightly different views from time to time. Because I personally, as a philosopher, right, I want to highlight to people what's going on and why we've got some of the issues we've got. And a lot of the issues is this narrow frame of reference that we've caught ourselves into and then being effectively amplified through the social media channels and everything else. And sometimes it's really good just to step back and question and say, well, what are the underlying assumptions that I've got that points me towards a particular point of view? And what are other people saying that have a different point of view? Maybe there's some validity to that too.
Yeah, I agree. And I think part of the problem sometimes is that there are some very easy low-hanging fruit things in our society, low-hanging fruit changes that could be made. You know, say, for example, like, let's stop the central banks blowing stupid bubbles, for example, and undermining social stability while tens of millions of people are going hungry. I think that 98% of us, the ones that aren't central bankers or are getting absurdly wealthy off of this, can agree on that.
Yep.
So why don't we do that? Oh, we can't. Because too many political donors or too many people in positions of power are taking advantage of that.
Hmm.
You know, and it's just little things like that. You know, like, you know, do we think that, say, for example, that no Australian child should go hungry?
Hmm.
No. Well, okay, cool. Let's do school lunches for every kid. Let's make sure no kid goes hungry. No kid goes without books or a uniform or all these different things. I don't think that there's very many people who disagree with these relatively basic things that we could all get together and sit around and sing Kumbaya and be able to actually say, look at what we achieved as a society. Look at what we all agree on. It just doesn't get done. And no. Yeah.
No, well, I agree. And, you know, the point is that it is the choices we make as individuals and as communities that actually determine how our society ends up. But at the moment, some of those look to me to be taking us into cul-de-sacs that are not particularly positive. But you're right. There are some fundamental principles I think you could begin to articulate about what the nature of our society should look like. And I suspect you'd get quite a lot of support for that until it got to the point of, okay, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, You're right, but that's everything, isn't it? You know, it's like with climate change. You know, everyone, you know, you look at these surveys. Oh, everyone wants action on climate change, and then they all turn around and vote for Scott Morrison, who the bloke who brought a piece of coal into Parliament.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, but I think that you make a good point about that, because I think it's important to have a good perspective on where public opinion actually sits on these various issues.
Yep.
You know, it's like, you know, say for example, you know, you talk to people, you go, nurses deserve a pay rise. And everyone goes, yeah. And then you go, we're going to have to raise taxes this much to pay for it. And then all of a sudden everything just goes sort of quiet instead, with a few people, you know, sort of, you know, overwhelmingly favoring it. And I think that's something that we just really need to do as a society, but I don't know. I think there is a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of, say, for example, like corporate tax avoidance. I mean, how many people really think that all these different companies that use all of these shell companies, that use all of these, you know, offshore special vehicles in Singapore to send their profits to, how many of us realistically disagree that we should bring that money back to Australia? Not many.
Well, except, of course, then they'd argue that, well, if you do it here, then they'll go offshore and... because it's an international problem, not just a local problem. And that takes us to the next level of complexity.
That's true. But, I mean, you just say, well, too bad. With this, you earn this revenue in Australia. You're going to pay the tax on it in Australia. If you don't like it, someone else will come in here who will pay the tax. And if you don't like it, get stuffed.
Yep. Yeah, sounds like a good plan. Okay, we're going to create a new party called the Get Stuffed Party, I think.
Oh, mate, despite the speculation of my grandmother that one day I would be prime minister of this country, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that, to be honest, I think that my temperament and, you know, my commitment to the truth would probably get me in trouble, because, you know, a lot of some folks prefer comforting lies over uncomfortable truths.
Yeah, that is a truth in itself, and an uncomfortable one too. But at least, you know, when you and I chat, we lay a few things bare and perhaps highlight a few issues to get people to think, which is what it's about. Tarek, I appreciate your time today. Very interesting conversation as always. We'll do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Looking forward to it.
Cheers. Take care.
You too, mate.